The Peak Podcast is brought to you by Nutritia and is designed for healthcare professionals only. Jill Perks, an NHS midwife, is asking the questions in this episode.
As healthcare professionals, we're familiar with high levels of stress, but the outbreak of COVID-19 has presented unprecedented challenges for clinicians. My name is Jill, and I've been a midwife and nurse in the NHS for almost 40 years. In this episode of the Beat podcast, I'm speaking to Professor Neil Greenberg. Neil is an academic psychiatrist based at King's College London. He's a specialist in the understanding and management of occupational mental ill health and post-traumatic stress disorder. His work as a psychiatrist and researcher has seen him deployed to hostile environments, including Afghanistan and Iraq. Neil is joining me today, of course remotely via the internet, to discuss how healthcare professionals can support their own mental health during this period. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning.
Neil, this is obviously a stressful and challenging time for many, but what kind of impact would you expect this outbreak to have on the mental health of healthcare professionals?
Well, clearly, at the moment, there's an awful lot going on, and healthcare professionals as a group are pulling together and doing amazing work, you know, saving lives across the United Kingdom and also across the world. I think it's fair to say that not all healthcare professionals are facing the same challenges. So those who are in primary care, for instance, are trying to work out how they can see patients who need to be seen, you know, but effectively deliver remote consultations in a way that perhaps they haven't done before. Certainly those I've spoken to recently who might be, say, providing oncology, cancer care treatments, are finding some real challenges there in trying to work out where the risk-benefit balance lies in trying to treat patients who need treatment for their cancer, but if they come into hospital and catch an infection, they would be in a very high-risk group. And then, of course, there's the large number of healthcare professionals who are providing frontline care to people who are in hospital with COVID-19 infections. And they, in particular, are really very much at what we would call the front line at the moment. I think it's just worth pointing out that although many of them have intensive care or critical care or anaesthetic expertise, there's also a huge number of staff who have come into the health service not to work in those specialities, or might have retired from the health service, or in some cases haven't yet qualified but are finishing their training early to help out. And those particularly inexperienced members of staff, when it comes to dealing with intensive care situations, are likely to be finding the current situation a real challenge. All that said, although it's very easy to focus on the negative mental health impacts of dealing with really difficult situations like the current one, I think it's also fair to say that actually in times of crisis, people tend to step up to the challenge and perform, you know, amazingly and probably better than many might expect them to. What happens in those situations is people tend to keep going for a while, and then should the crisis continue for a long period of time, they can often sort of emotionally or sometimes even physically feel that they want to collapse after having sort of lived on the adrenaline of performing amazingly over a period of time. For even those who don't collapse, and I hope many of them won't, obviously the time when they begin to try and recover from what they've been through, it's a critical time, and they have to think carefully about trying to get back to whatever the new normal is versus taking the time that they're likely to need to catch their breath and to sort of feel rejuvenated before going back to normal work. And put that all together, what you tend to have is this kind of strange balance between the risk of becoming unwell because of the traumatic experiences or the intense workload versus actually the risk of what's called post-traumatic growth, which is actually the summed up is anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And it's very likely, I think, that a number of healthcare professionals will come out of this, you know, really challenging time and actually think, do you know, if I could do all of that, then actually I think that I'm feeling pretty tough for whatever comes next.
That's interesting. So it appears that through crisis, for some healthcare professionals, they will develop a type of resilience. And actually, they will in some way grow in that resilience through this, these types of circumstances.
Absolutely. So a lot of my career I spent in the armed forces, and obviously worked with military personnel who go to funny places and do strange things, often with a great deal of threat. And actually, the current crisis is rather similar to that, because, of course, healthcare professionals themselves are often threatened by the risk of infection, either of themselves or of people that they come into contact with. The other similar challenge, actually, at the moment to military life is the challenge of what we call moral injury. So it's the injury to one's moral or ethical code. And at the moment, a lot of healthcare professionals are having to make really difficult decisions where they don't necessarily have the right experience, there aren't enough staff around, and there may not even be sufficient or the right equipment to hand in order to enable them to sort of carry out the high quality care they want to. But you put that all together, and actually when they do sort of face these challenges and actually do well out of it and actually learn and actually form a good team and can experience perhaps something they haven't experienced in the past, given the challenges the healthcare services faces at times, that they do well, they save lives, they work as a team, and at least currently that the public certainly are very much behind them. And that is a very kind of delightful and wonderful experience that is likely to lead to people, as you say, you know, improving their own psychological resilience.
Neil, you've described a variety of different issues and challenges facing healthcare professionals. You've talked about healthcare professionals actually working in the front line, and the obvious fears that will create. You've talked about the impact of potentially, you didn't use the word, but you sort of alluded to sort of a type of a burnout, a type of collapse at some point. What are the signs that our healthcare professionals can look for, or what can we look for in our colleagues to see that they may need some kind of support?
So all the evidence that we have from how organisations function show really clearly that the most likely people to spot someone with a difficulty are those people immediately around them. So their colleagues, but also their family as well. And most importantly, their immediate supervisor. So there's kind of two parts to how to work out if someone's having a difficulty. One is that the individual themselves may be able to recognise that they're a bit more jumpy, they're not sleeping well, they may be drinking more, they may be more irritable. But quite often we tend to ignore those signs and kind of justify or rationalise them and say, suggest to ourselves that actually it's not an indication that we're not coping well. However, people around us, you know, those friends, family, colleagues, supervisors, they often can spot someone who has changed. And this may become sort of obvious in either sort of changes in the way they behave, in their performance, their anger, their irritability, changes in their emotions, so appearing to be teary, you know, shouting more, perhaps being withdrawn, changes in the way they're thinking. So they may think more negatively, which might be a bigger change, or they might express more anxiety through their thoughts about what's going to happen and whether they're doing well. And also we know that people can experience an increase in physical symptoms. So many of us, when we're psychologically distressed, tend to experience sort of stomach pains or more aches or other sort of physical difficulties that actually the cause of them is psychological. So I think the advice would be is that if you can take a moment to reflect on really how you're doing and to go through those four bits, how I'm thinking, what are my emotions are like, what's my behaviour like, what's my physical symptoms, that can be quite helpful as sort of a daily or at least a periodic check on your own kind of mental health status. But I think it's really important that people around them, particularly colleagues and immediate supervisors, don't feel shy in saying to people who have changed that they're worried about them, and to particularly point out what it is that's caused them to be worried. So a sort of suggestion such as something like, well, I saw you, you know, get really angry this off a couple of time on shift, you know, is everything okay? Or I noticed when you sort of came out on your break, you know, you normally chat to everyone, but you were sort of sitting by yourself staring into the distance, you know, is everything okay? So pointing out specifically what it is that you've noticed in someone else actually can be really helpful as a way to kind of open the door to have a really meaningful conversation.
So I guess the simple steps are just to be real about this and just try as sensitively as possible to approach somebody if you're concerned about the behaviours that they're exhibiting. Are there any other steps that healthcare professionals can take? Are there any support groups? You know, how can we support people who really do seem to be suffering with their mental health?
So the general approach is to have what we would very much readily see in healthcare anyway, which is to have a stepped care kind of model. And that actually, in most cases, if you can get someone to open that psychological door and actually have a meaningful conversation with them about how they're doing and what they're feeling and thinking and what they're worried about, often the actual act of listening can be really helpful in itself. But at the end of that conversation, it's really useful to try and come up with a specific plan about what the individual can do and maybe how you can help them to improve their situation. So practical things sort of definitely come top of the list. So that might be taking a shower when they haven't had one, going for a run, having the day off, making sure they get to bed early, speaking to their loved one about a particular concern they got within the family, all those very practical things that sometimes we put on hold and don't do, but they cause us to feel emotionally distressed at times. If that sort of approach is not going to be sufficient, then absolutely the next level would be to use informal support mechanisms. And that might be a sort of group that someone might go to. There's quite a lot of virtual chat rooms now. And the NHS actually as a whole has made available a whole variety of different sorts of apps that are free to download, whereas before they would have cost. And things like Sleepio that helps with sleep, or Headspace, which is sort of a mindfulness app. The other thing the NHS has also made available on a national basis is a 24-hour text-back service, so you can speak confidentially to someone who really understands healthcare workers, and that can be quite useful. People might quite like that because it gives a high degree of anonymity. You don't really need to tell people too much about who you are. There's also a 7 o'clock in the morning till 11 at night helpline run by the Samaritans, but very much focused on healthcare staff working at the moment. And again, that's an informal listening service, and that can be really helpful. Most employers also have employee assistance programs, and these are counselling services that they've been paying for years. And the counsellors on the line should be able to provide a number of sessions of supportive work with individuals. And again, they might well find that useful. And then lastly, you know, if none of that kind of stuff works, then really you should be getting to go and see someone who is a mental health professional who can actually do a proper assessment and really help you work out what it is you might need to get you well. In the unfortunate circumstance that you have gone on and developed a mental health problem, what we know is, unfortunately, most people don't go and seek help. And therefore, if we can get people into professional care early on, actually the treatment's often a lot simpler, and the chance of them getting back to a good state of health, and just as importantly, back to work, is really quite high. Whereas if we delay seeking help, and then what can happen is people begin to lose their relationships because people get annoyed with them. They lose their self-confidence. Sometimes they even lose their job. And then by the time they actually seek help, some months or usually years later on, actually, although you can treat the underlying mental health problem, getting back all those social and secondary losses can be really quite challenging.
Neil, you have extensive experience in war zones. How does that experience inform your approach to assessing frontline healthcare professionals in facing COVID-19?
So when the military sends troops to funny places around the world, if the tour of duty is going to be challenging, or if there's a large number of troops who go, a mental health team goes with them as part of the healthcare setup. That mental health team actually doesn't do classic mental health care. It's not there to provide ongoing monitoring of medication or long-term therapy. What it's there for very much is to do what's called frontline psychiatry, which is basically doing everything they can to try and make sure that the troops who are on deployment stay fighting fit, or where they do develop mental health problems, that the military takes a nip it in the bud approach and tries to derail serious disorders so that people can carry on functioning. And what that means is that instead of thinking about the long-term treatments that people have, and instead of looking for serious illnesses, what military mental health professionals do is to look for triggers of resilience and to look for practical solutions to how to keep people functioning. We use a set of principles called the PIES principles, which stands for proximity. So treat people near where they are having difficulties. Immediacy says if people have got problems, don't let them become a crisis. Get in there early, nip it in the bud. Expectancy, treat people with the expectation that they're going to be okay, that they just need a bit of a rest and some practical solutions. And S is simplicity, which means that actually simple things make a big difference. Often a good night's sleep, for instance, can be all that you need to kind of help reset yourself and get going. And the use of those principles on the battlefield, we know, doesn't just lead to short-term gains in having troops around. We know that it leads to long-term mental health outcomes. A 20-year study carried out by the Israeli military showed exactly that. So I think at the moment, healthcare professionals working to support healthcare workers on the front line can adopt those very similar principles and do everything we can to both keep people at the front line and also to protect their mental health in the long term.
Neil, we've talked quite a bit about people actually in the workplace, but what about our colleagues who are unable to attend work at the moment? That must be hard for them. I mean, there's a variety of people. For example, you know, perhaps some who are living with a family member who has had a contact, so they need to self-isolate for a number of days. Some with underlying health conditions, and we're describing that as people who are shielding. I mean, that must present some challenges for them as well. I'm sure it can't be easy. It's not just like having a great holiday from work, is it?
No, I absolutely agree. I mean, one of the kind of underlying core beliefs in most healthcare workers is the wanting to help and the wanting to make a difference, which is a great motivating factor for why many of us do the work that we do. And feeling frustrated because you can't add to that national effort is likely to be distressing. In fact, our team at King's College London did a research paper, which we published in February this year, which is a rapid review. And what we were looking at there was the impact of quarantine on people's mental health. At that time, we were particularly interested in it because we were bringing back people from around the world and putting them into quarantine for periods of time. Obviously, the world's changed since then. But one of the overriding features that came out of that rapid evidence-based review was that healthcare workers were at increased risk of suffering with mental health problems as a result of being in quarantine. And it seemed to be that one of the reasons for that was that they really wanted to help and that not being allowed to do so was particularly distressing for them. I think, though, there is, and it's difficult to think about this sort of straight off, but in life generally, there are times when we all have the ability to rise to the challenge. We might not have kids, we might not have any commitments, and therefore we can work longer hours and do more. And then at other times of our life, that's just not possible. And this may well be that sort of time for many healthcare professionals. Often, though, they can add quite a lot to the national effort. They can be available to support their colleagues remotely, maybe even also carrying out remote consultations. Certainly many healthcare professionals, GPs and mental health professionals included, you know, are providing, you know, really high quality care, but doing it over the internet. And actually, in some ways, that might seem a bit strange at first, but it may well teach us all a better way of working going forward. So I think the idea that if you are sort of trapped in a situation rather than thinking about what you can't do, there may be lots of opportunities to try and think slightly differently about what you can do and how you can not just help patients, which will be great, but also help those colleagues of yours who are doing really challenging work, sort of stay in contact and with you, and you can socially support them. And I have no doubt that they will find that incredibly useful as well.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it, that although we are not physically with one another at times, the connectedness actually does feel quite strong. And given what healthcare professionals are achieving in terms of keeping all types of patients safe, you know, remotely, one can only speculate that the world will never be the same again, certainly in healthcare services.
I think on that, it's interesting because I'm involved in lots of different groups looking at the psychological health of healthcare workers, but also of the population as a whole. I've worked on this topic for many years, not obviously in the same situation as now, because this is, as we say too many times perhaps, but it is unprecedented. But if you look about the impact of psychologically traumatic events on populations and individuals generally, what happens after any traumatic event is the media are very quick to say life will never be the same again, this will change us all, you know, the world is irrevocably different to how it's going to be in the future. And then when you do follow-up studies 6-8 months, you know, a year later, actually you find that most things have returned to pretty much the same as they were before, and that actually all those predictions of doom and gloom actually don't come to fruition. And I think what we need to do is to think quite carefully is that there inevitably will be a proportion of people who absolutely will suffer some real serious mental health problems as a result of it. But I don't think we should ignore the fact that, you know, there will be potentially a lot of good we can take from the current situation once this is all over, although it may be hard to see that just at the moment.
So now you've described, Neil, that in the longer term, some of the positive outcomes of our current circumstances will include that we perhaps are prompted to have a greater sense of sensitivity and awareness of the colleagues around us and their mental health, and indeed our own mental health. And, you know, we have perhaps paid more attention to a greater connectedness, albeit remotely, than we ever have before. I think perhaps one of the most challenging elements of this crisis is uncertainty. I think that's difficult for all of us. So how can we specifically support our healthcare workers with that sense of uncertainty?
I think all the population, healthcare workers and everyone else at the moment, has a great sense of uncertainty about the future, because that is the case. I think no one really knows quite what is going to happen. However, there are lots of conflicting stories with different experts suggesting different views, and media stories coming out, often sort of exciting and dramatic, and sometimes completely and utterly wrong. What we have to do is to try and pin our beliefs and our truths on sources of information that are the most likely to be credible. So if you're a member of the public, then actually, although you might listen to lots of media sources, you really should be listening to the government briefings, or what the NHS website says, or what Public Health England say. No one knows what the truth is, but they are the most credible sources at the moment. If you're working in a trust, then although you'll hear lots of stories about what might happen and who might have done what, I think you have to listen to the official version of events, not because you don't want to believe other things, but because in the world of uncertainty, if you have nothing to pin your certainty onto, then that's incredibly distressing. So choose one source, hopefully an official source, and try and ignore the other things that you hear, which may be different, you know, be they good or bad stories. And certainly what we're advising members of the public to do at the moment strongly is to listen to the official briefings. But if you are looking at the news regularly and finding it makes you anxious, then you should just stop, because it's not going to be helpful. And it's not as if there is a really truthful answer out there that you could find, because no one knows what the truth is. And therefore, just stick to the official line, and that's likely to help you, no matter whether you're a healthcare worker or just a member of the public.
Neil, that is all we have time for today. So thank you for joining us and sharing such useful advice to help support healthcare professionals during this very challenging time. Thank you.
Thank you very much as well.
To keep up to date with future episodes of the Beat podcast from Nutritia, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, as well as lots of other educational content from Nutritia, sign up to our newsletter at www.nutritia.co.uk. We'll be right back.